Thank you, George, and welcome, everyone. I'm looking over at the sidebar and just appreciating all of the places that people are arriving from. So thank you so much for being here today. And thank you for the technology that makes this work. I also like to remind people that we want to bring patience and acceptance to technology. Hopefully it'll run really smoothly, but it's our practice to meet what is with presence and acceptance. So as we begin, any conversation about climate crisis, any conversation about practice, I find it most helpful to begin from the place of gratitude. And one of the things I teach is a piece of work called The Work That Reconnects, which some of you might know. This is a field of work for transforming our pain for our world into compassionate action, created by Joanna Macy. And we always begin with gratitude. So wherever you are right now, I invite you to turn to gratitude, to first feel our gratitude for togetherness, for just being here together. To ask yourself what it is that you feel bone deep gratitude for today. And, you know, before we continue, I notice a little bit of background noise. So I just want to point that out to George in case there's a way to quiet it so that we can have even more of a quiet, focused sound experience. So let's just see. Maybe someone can give feedback on the sidebar and let us know how it's going. So let's go ahead and begin with our meditation, followed by Dharma teaching and the period I most enjoy, which is questions, interaction, conversation, coming together. And so the first thing that I'd like to invite, coming from the Zen tradition always, is that we bring awareness to how we take our seat, the teaching of taking our seat. For practice, taking our seat for any important conversation, the fact that we have a choice in every moment for how we show up, that we can literally, somatically, energetically take our seat in dignity, in presence, in deep listening. And so just bring awareness as you begin to either rest your eyes closed or open in a soft gaze. Bring awareness, please, to how you are taking your seat. Being aware of the ground, the earth beneath you. Aware of the meeting point between your sits bones and whatever cushion or chair is supporting you. Just noticing what it's like to transition from whatever you were just engaged in to this time for deepening practice. And let's take in together three of the deepest and slowest breaths we have taken today. Just feeling the air as it enters your body, fills your body, and leaves your body. Feeling your body's connection with gravity, with the earth beneath you, and allowing yourself to settle, really letting this earth support you, allowing your sits bones, your posture, to support your spine. Connecting with the qualities of strong back, open heart, as we begin to settle. Notice if there are any adjustments you want to make in your physical posture. And as you allow your breath to return to its natural rhythm, just notice what that is in this moment. Appreciating the spirit of this posture in which we take our seats and show up to what is with welcome and a willingness to be here. And so allowing your breath to be your anchor, noticing where in your body you connect most easily with your breath. Let's bring awareness first to the inner landscape. Just noticing what's moving through in this moment. Your physical experience. Your mind. Emotional body. Just welcoming whatever is moving through. Welcoming the deeper undercurrents of our experience as we continue to settle in. Allowing mind and body to integrate organically as we begin to notice a little more space within and out. And as you continue to settle, becoming gently curious about where your physical body ends and the space around you begins. As we meditate together, breath and body as anchor We allow awareness to expand organically with each breath that we take. Simply present and open to the inner and outer landscape at the same time. Open to the interconnected nature of awareness itself. Field consciousness or we consciousness. Just remembering for a moment that our very breath connects us with each other, connects us with our ancestors who breathed the same air we are breathing, connects us with the trees and forests, the oceans and phytoplankton. The stardust that makes up our planet. Remembering that there's nothing to do. Nothing to solve or fix or change. Nowhere to get to. And nothing to strive for, just allowing ourselves to rest here. In the intimacy that allows life to be as it is. And if you notice efforting in your meditation, just see if you can allow a little softening. If you notice busy mind in your meditation today, just see if you can welcome busy mind. Meeting what is without any resistance. We can think of meditation as listening to life as it unfolds, as it emerges moment by moment. And the more we soften and surrender in our meditation, there's an experience of letting ourselves be listened to, be held in the unfolding moment by moment. Just noticing what is here for you in the mirror of stillness today. Noticing the space within and out the spacious nature of awareness itself. And in the spirit of emergence, allowing the rise and fall of your breath to remind you that every ending, every exhalation is also a beginning. That every beginning, every inhalation is also an ending. That we exist as part of the interdependent nexus web of interconnection. That is life on earth, in constant flux, change, emergence. And just reflecting for a moment on the simplicity of that. How does emergence position us to give ourselves fully to resting in the moment, to listening deeply to the unfolding moment by moment, to respond moment by moment to life from this deep listening? As part of emergence. So please, very gently, allow your breath to deepen now. Maybe resting your attention at the center of your chest, where you can feel the expansion and contraction of your lungs and rib cage while you breathe. And if you'd like to, you can rest your hand on your heart for a moment. Just to take a couple of minutes at the end of our meditation for compassion. Just noticing what part or parts of you most need compassion in this moment. Noticing the compassion expressed simply energetically through hand on heart. A sense of I am with you, I'm here. Perhaps feeling a sense of expressing affection for this human. And you can also notice if there might be any expression of words, of reassurances that you might offer yourself in this moment. In other words, any expression that feels like a genuine and generous expression of compassion. Knowing that sometimes it is as simple and distilled as, I love you. Keep going. So I'd like for us to take in one more deep breath together. Breathing in deeply, exhaling fully. And when you're ready, please gently open your eyes. So welcome again, everyone. I feel really grateful to be here with all of you and to be here for the topic of compassion, more honestly, fierce compassion, emergence, and climate change. I feel that we need to create together as many restorative circles in the name of connecting and supporting one another through our practice in this age of climate crisis as possible. So let's once again bring awareness to how we take our seat. Bringing awareness to your physical posture and to really embodying a sense of groundedness. Earth connection is one of our greatest supports in practice and certainly as we navigate global uncertainty. Chogyam Trungpa used to say, "Do not be like a wilted flower." And so I love that image when we take our seats, committing to showing up with dignity, with presence, taking responsibility for our practice, remembering to not be like a wilted flower. And I think of, because I'm a passionate gardener, flowers that are planted in healthy soil and well watered, the natural elongation. So perhaps noticing a little more space in your spine as you find a physical position that really expresses center to you. And I'd like to begin by just sharing a couple of quotes. The first being a poem that I have long loved, by the 14th century Zen monk and poet Ikkyu Sojin. Every day, priests minutely examine the laws and endlessly chant complicated sutras. Before doing this, though, they should learn how to read the love letters sent by the wind and rain, the snow and moon. Just taking a moment to take that in. And the second is simply a statement of truth by Paul Stamets. We are not an individual. We are a vast network of molecules, energies, vibrations. The interconnectedness of being is who we are. And so I love both of those quotes as reminders of why we practice. I frame today's teaching as eco-dharma, but just to be very clear, I consider all dharma eco-dharma. We have a very strong tendency toward anthropocentrism in our modern world, which some of you may have noticed. And so this can even trickle down into our spiritual practice sometimes, but our earth connection, the Gaia consciousness, which reminds us of our interbeing with all of life. This is why we practice, and this is the truth of our practice. Yeah. So, as I shared at the very beginning, I really want to frame today's teaching in gratitude. And there are a few, I would say, orientations that are really, really helpful as we embark on any conversation about the climate crisis and practice. And so first, I just want you to close your eyes for a moment and just reflect on where you are regarding climate change, how it has been, even this summer, to witness globally more intense hurricanes, flooding, fires, displacement of peoples than we have seen all at once. So this acceleration of climate change that I know has been such a sobering and tender experience for so many of us. So I find it really important as part of taking our seat to set the intention to meet this kind of conversation from embodied deep listening. That means, well, if it's any conversation that I consider an important topic, this means dropping down from our heads into our bodies, away from the realm of concepts and ideas, into the heart of our relational intelligence, our innate receptivity, our deep listening. Number two, welcoming the both and nature of our practice. In other words, that we are not here to reach for conclusions, but to explore possibility together. In fact, as we engage in an emergent conversation, even grief, which is one of the things I'll talk about today, can coexist and does coexist with joy, with our vibrant aliveness. I recently heard someone share that grief and ecstasy are two sides of the same coin. And I reflected on a bit, and what I really saw for myself was, yes, because through embodiment, it's by going down and into our bodies, into our earth connection, deeply, fiercely, in the moment, that we are willing to feel our full grief through our love for our world. And this is the exact same channel we follow to explore and to know our ecstasy as sentient beings alive on planet Earth. And when we numb out one, we numb out the other. So two sides of the same coin. Also, that through this both and approach, we can, through our practice, know the value and the vital importance of acceptance, learning how to be sober and accept what is unfolding, while at the same time, side by side, stepping more fully into compassionate action. What is appropriate response? What are the actions from my heart that I can be taking to serve life in this time, at the same time as acceptance helps me to take my seat more fully in my willingness to serve? Yeah. And so I think now and then through this talk, I might refer to a couple of quotes. I recently finished writing a new book, and I'm feeling really touched and grateful to be at that moment in the process, finished. And so the first quote that I wanted to share is simply that it is in our willingness to show up generously for one another in shared presence that we provide to ourselves and to each other the nourishment, the sustenance that we really deeply need to navigate global uncertainty. So let's practice that while we're in this gathering together. Thich Nhat Hanh said that the most important thing we can be doing in the face of the climate crisis is to hear the tears of the earth through our own bodies, to hear and feel the tears of the earth through our own bodies. So again, the importance of going down into our bodies. And I underline this because many of us, I imagine, feel like you've witnessed a whole lot over many years, over decades, in fact, of people talking and reading, talking and thinking about climate change without really taking the helpful actions, yeah? And also such a tendency in today's world to read surface news about what's going on without being gifted restorative spaces, which I hope this is today, to come together, to feel our way through our experience. This is so important because each and every one of us is part of the natural feedback system of life on Earth. This is who we are as part of Gaia consciousness. So turning towards rather than away from those feelings is turning towards the tears of the earth. And remember that our love and pain for life are inextricably linked. Yeah. So I would like to offer a disclaimer, and that's that I'm not a climate scientist. Okay. I'm a Dharma teacher. I'm someone who throughout the entire time of my practice has known that the natural world is our greatest and truest teacher. And I've been an environmental educator for a long time. And I just want to share that I came to practice, to my commitment to practice as a young person in college, as a student of environmental studies and ecological design, a moment in time for me when I was being both mind blown by what seemed to open up through the Dharma, like drinking water from a pure crystalline spring, after witnessing a world where I could see the overconsumption, where I could see the tendency towards greed, hate, and delusion, and at the same time opening my eyes in awe to really the miracle of the natural world and the regenerative nature of natural ecosystems, the resilience of different forms of life that understand that adaptation, emergence, collaboration, communication, relational intelligence are really, really important. So that said, my choice to become a monk and to give myself to practice was very much a part of my question of what is conscious response given what we're up against environmentally and socially in our world. And yet for a long time, I think I was seeing through kind of an orientation that I've heard many colleagues, both Dharma colleagues and colleagues in the environmental field name, as kind of an assumption that if we could open humanity's eyes, open humanity's consciousness a little more fully, then things can change. People would obviously get on board to being of service in ways that we need to be, given what we're up against. And really, really has been humbling to come to a point of realizing a number of years ago, I think that assumption was a bit false, and that the forces we're up against regarding global corporate capitalism and globalization are simply too strong. So I now believe that we need to be asking new questions and that we have a lot to learn and to be fortified by through strengthening aspects of our practice, which I want to talk about today, and through the teachings of emergence. So think of the climate crisis like a tree with many branches. Today we're going to focus on the trunk, which is compassion, what we are facing, which is something none of our ancestors have faced, even if they witnessed the decimation of entire peoples through, for instance, genocide. Never before was there the possibility of decimation of our species and the witnessing already the loss of so many other species, ecosystems, forms of life. And so we're also going to focus on the nature of the tree itself, which is emergence. But I just want to name for people who want to go deeper that there are many other branches that are equally valuable to explore. For instance, the connection between climate crisis and trauma, the connection between climate crisis and white supremacy, of course, our whole history of extraction and colonialism. Kriti Kenko, who is a dear friend, Dharma teacher, and climate scientist, says brilliantly, I think, that climate crisis stems from white supremacy. White supremacy stems from the root of trauma. And so there's so many areas for us to explore. And I'll just offer humbly that on my website, on the blog page, for those who wish, there is a resource list that you might find helpful if you choose to go deeper in some of the explorations, if you want to ground yourself more fully and how can I be of service during this time, okay? So grief as our starting point, the need to hold restorative spaces for collective grief is so, so important. And it's so counterintuitive in a world where the dominant paradigm tends to hold on to a tendency towards what I call sunshining. We're going to try to keep it light and get to the light, even in the ways we approach enlightenment sometimes, while trying to avoid the dark or trying to avoid our discomfort. Realizing that what we're facing now through global uncertainty really is a great teacher of discomfort resiliency, the need to turn towards what we deem dark to access our inner strength or light. Yeah. And as we grieve, as we really allow spaces to do this together, to feel our feelings for what is unfolding and for the loss we've already witnessed, this is how we directly access more of a fierce compassion, more of a fierce compassion. So just reflect for a moment in your own being, in your own life, your understanding or your connection to fierce compassion, perhaps how through your practice, your personal journey, you've been asked to meet with over time an unrelenting love, that which you used to turn away from, or ways you which you've been asked to develop a compassionate self-discipline, even around your daily practice that has become quite fierce. In other words, quite resilient, quite tenacious, because that's required. Sometimes compassion is really, really gentle. And you all know this. Sometimes it's as simple as meeting what is with the energy of acceptance, with the counterintuitive embrace of soft welcome. A tremendous healing occurs, or meeting another through listening and being a presence at their side through their suffering. Sometimes compassion is fierce, and this means that, as an example, the energy that we feel in both our grief and at times outrage, which I'll talk about in a moment, about what's happening in our world, gets used as a fuel, in a sense, transmuted, brought fully into our hearts when we don't turn away from those more primal emotions and energy. We don't become them and act out of them, but we instead, through practice, get to step back and turn towards and bring into our hearts energies that end up giving us even more willingness to set boundaries between what is true and what is not. That means boundaries with the conditioned mind itself. We each become a spiritual warrior in practice for truth versus the stories of the conditioned mind, okay? Equally with collective conditioning and the stories of collective conditioning. There might be another quote that I want to read. And I think instead I'll just say it in this moment. It's that we have to have so much compassion for ourselves being in this place that we are as a collective, because the fish does not always see the water in which it swims. And even if it is the heart's imperative to go beyond the limitations, the stories, the long passed down legacies of greed, hate, and delusion, even if it is the heart's imperative, okay, to see clearly, the intersubjective nature of the conditioned mind makes it so we often tend to believe that which is not real, but our neighbors are believing it, our relatives are believing it, our ancestors believed it and passed it down, such that, for instance, the myth of separation, the myth that we are separate from one another, from the natural world, the tendency to see life through hierarchical perception rather than seeing clearly what is, which our practice invites us into. We assume this is the natural order of things sometimes, yeah? So we want to have a lot of compassion for ourselves, remembering the intersubjective nature of conditioning, okay? Pause and consider this. In today's world, many people tend to react to the state of the world with a handful of limited responses. So just look within as I name these and see if you've found yourself in any of these places ever. Finger-pointing righteousness. It's their fault. It's the fault of big business. Okay, this finger-pointing righteousness. Paralyzing despair. There is nothing, nothing I can do. I am contracted in my despair. A doom and gloom approach, which I find it fascinating when we look around and we see that doom and gloom approach focused on Armageddon, even played out so often in Hollywood, in the cinema, in our entertainment, in the stories we create and imagine collectively. Another limited approach is business as usual. You know what? That's just too big a topic. I'm not going to go there. Let's just keep it to business as usual. Everything's fine. Or even a Pollyanna approach. Love will pave the way. So nothing for me to look at. Okay. And I encourage us to just consider how easy it can be to go into some of those more surface responses, but the invitation of our practice and the gift of our practice is really positioning us to listen to the deeper undercurrents of what's happening right now, letting ourselves be both sobered and called into more of a wakeful, compassionate response, okay? So this is, in part, important because a lot of energy gets lost. A lot of our life force gets taken by those reactive responses. And I think many of you, like me, have seen, for instance, in the past couple years of the coronavirus, a level of both reactivity and divisiveness that we can see is really unhelpful. It's not nourishing to the collective human spirit. It's really disheartening. It's caused a tear in the fabric of human relationship. So the tools we have from our practice become even more invaluable to point us to a groundedness and relational intelligence. Yeah. So grieving first, this is the first step and the most important step, which opens up our fierce compassion, which begins to free up energy. And it's like that which we've been turning away from instead becomes compost and nutrient to give back to the soil to help us live in a more regenerative way now and to help us regenerate as we navigate something so mind-blowingly sobering, okay? Emergence is the next helpful teacher. And emergence is of life. Our practice is such a generous teacher of emergence, learning how to anchor ourselves in the present, recognizing dependent co-arising, recognizing ourselves not as separate, as individual, but as part of this continual unfolding, our part in all of life, our part with all of life. I'm going to read a short excerpt from my writing, Emergence. Is the teacher of Gaia consciousness living in constant adaptation, communication, and collaboration. Consider that 3.7 million years ago, molecules of carbon and oxygen organized themselves into living cells, creating the first living entities of biological life. Through many mass extinctions and climate shifts over time, the slate has been wiped clear, and most of what has been before is gone. New patterns have emerged. Rather than focusing on what was lost from the Ice Age, for instance, what was lost when a giant meteor slammed into the Earth and created mass extinction, we can recognize in our hearts that change is not just the end of something. Through emergence, something new is always created. After the Ice Age, glaciers melted and there existed nothing but rock. From the air emerged spores of magical fungi, algae, and fungi made lichen began to break down the rock in the blink of the biological eye. There were plants forming and growing. We are the first humans, consider this for a moment, that have existed on planet Earth, that have been here to witness the forming of a new geological age. That is mind-blowing. And so, alongside our grief, alongside the grief that we feel for that which feels overwhelming, for that which has been in momentum for a really, really long time without humans intervening and changing course, we can also reach into our hearts and practice and access a quality of awe, reverence for the mystery, even the quality of beginner's mind, which positions us to remember wonder as a source of wisdom. Not turning to awe to bypass what is ours to take responsibility for now, and the both and nature of acceptance and action, both. We can live in both. But I take great heart when I allow myself as a living being to remember emergence and to understand that there's an opportunity right now to learn how to relate with the mystery itself in a way that I feel humans have allowed to be usurped by a sense, a belief that we are separate, a sense that we are isolated, a sense that we can control life, a sense that the technological era is the wave of the future, can save us, that our practice, our Dharma practice itself, invites us to learn to meet the mystery with absolute reverence rather than fear, and to remember the stillness itself that positions us not in concept but experientially to reconnect with the reverence for emergence and the humility about our place in that. So just pause and consider what this stirs in you, what this brings forth in you. For me, when I anchor in emergence and fierce compassion and grief as my tripod, we might say, this really frees up a whole lot of energy that instead of that going to fear, instead of that going to, but why? Well, we know well why. We could have an hour conversation right now about how we got here. But it allows us to actually take more of a passionate responsibility for what it means to be alive in this moment in time. I believe our practice prepares us for this. I believe we were made for these times, and that these times call forth everything that we've got. Not that which we don't have, that which we innately are, and our practice reveals for us. This is what I'm pointing to. So, you know, it's incredibly, incredibly humbling to see how many layers there are to be with as we navigate our changing climate, how many layers of grief and sadness and letdown. And I find that the teaching of emergence and staying in reverence to the mystery helps us to avoid going to conclusions that give us something to hold on to that's actually flimsy but feels safe, and instead stay in the moment where we can be responding wakefully. There are so many actions, compassionate actions, to be taking in this time, both to support those who are being impacted most directly, and of course, because of the relationship between climate and race inequity, it's often going to be populations of color who are impacted the worst. There are so many actions to be taking, which can, science doesn't know too well to what degree, slow down. But certainly, this is the teaching of practice. Is our motivation towards a specific outcome, or is our motivation because this is who we are, to each moment make the choice that serves life? That serves life. So all of the courageous movements going on right now towards regenerative agriculture, towards creative ways to slow down carbon emissions, towards supporting, for instance, in the United States, there's a wonderful Indigenous environmental network that takes direct actions against the pipeline that some of you might know about that would certainly add to climate change tenfold. The courageous actions of the species rebellion movement. I could go on and on, but I'm just reminding us that in addition to our relational intelligence, in addition to our choice to meet this from the heart of openness and wisdom, there are equally actions we can each take which disrupt a paralyzing despair. Yeah. But I want to emphasize that at least I find it useful to completely let go of any need for justifying action by, does science prove this will make a difference, or is this the thing that's going to slow things down, or not at all? From my heart of hearts, who cares? Because from my heart of hearts, it's about who we are as human beings. And the choice we have is to serve life in every moment, regardless of outcome. I hope that's clear. I think I just want to share a couple more reflections before we open it up. And I really want to offer an encouragement for people to just be mindful of your relationship with news so that you're practicing what I call spiritual hygiene. And that means taking in information when you're centered and doing what you need to do to integrate, to metabolize our pain, to metabolize grief, to protect yourself, and I suggest the human spirit, from getting caught in this reactive, heady, and conceptual response to something so big. You know, I just want to remind us of one more thing, and that's how much compassion we need to have for ourselves for being in this place, but remembering that everything that has led to the climate crisis is part of our ancestral DNA. It's not done by just someone out there. I take heart in knowing that that as a human being, I hold part responsibility for where we are and that allows me again to take my seat in honest and conscious response rather than taking the seat of victimization. Okay. And it's true, human beings traditionally are wildly short-sighted. Yeah. We didn't know that by investing energy in building dams in rivers, that we would actually offset the access of our planet, of the earth. We'd create a wobble in the axis of the earth. That's mind-blowing. We didn't know once upon a time that through extracting fossil fuels from our planet to heat and light up this earth, we did not necessarily know that that would lead to what scientists are calling an irreversible change in the balance of atmosphere, soil, water, the health needed for life to survive here. I could go on. We didn't know in the Green Revolution, which we thought was creating hybrid seeds to give to third world countries to assist with the world food crisis, that it would make things 10 times worse and create a level of pollution and cultural degradation. That is mind-blowing. So again, the amount of compassion we need to have for what we're inheriting, that's what I'm pointing to. Can this nourish our fierce compassion, folks? And can we remember the tripod that I'll name just once more, of willingness to grieve, willingness to let that grief as a felt experience open up new and regenerative sources of energy within us, so that our energy is not going so much to fear and story, please, but instead to that which can nourish us and help us to receive guidance from a compass much, much more multidimensional and interconnected than our linear and logical mind, what I call the mind of limitation and separation, so we can navigate skillfully what we have to navigate now. It's high level, right? And also adding to that tripod emergence, which is simply our teacher in having complete reverence for the mystery and remembering as we see ourselves as part of emergence, this means, at least to me, that I can know, yes, my contribution matters. My choices each day matter. Something is emerging and I'm a part of it. And so can I really take loving responsibility, joyful responsibility, for what I contribute to the morphic field each day, yeah? Okay, I've gone on quite a bit, and I want to pause and really thank you for being here and invite questions or reflections. Just invite the space to be open and remind you that you can ask questions or share reflections directly related to what I've spoken to today. And you can also remember that it's all related. There might just be something bubbling up for you around compassion, or bubbling up for you around a place in practice that you're looking for a skillful response rather than a conditioned reaction. So the space is open, and I would love to hear from you. And I acknowledge humbly just what a short time we have together today to explore a big topic. So there is always an invitation to go deeper. Okay. Let's see. I see a question. Yeah, if it's possible to place your questions in the question box, that would be great. Let's see. So with a grateful, great, thank you. Someone suggesting that I find an alternative to the term third world countries. And I really appreciate that because that implies a hierarchy on value based on certain countries. I really appreciate that. And also just to acknowledge that it is fascinating because hierarchical perception is built into so much of our language. It's mind-blowing. And so it's always useful when we point this out to one another kindly. Thank you. Does anyone here today care to enter a conversation, to speak to what's in your heart? Just take a moment and look within and see. Something that I appreciate in practice spaces is that we don't need to fill the space. We can really be with spacious presence together as we notice what's churning inside and as we notice what questions or inquiries might be here. So we'll take our time and just listen within and notice if there's anything that would support you in your practice today. And of course, while we're waiting to see if there's any inquiries, we simply allow ourselves to rest, to meditate. So someone chimed in and shared, "I tend to ping pong between loving and hating the human experience. How can I calm the ping ponging?" So maybe people listening can just connect within to your own, how you relate to that question and how you relate to the experience, perhaps ping ponging. And here's what I would share. I find it really helpful and really practical in practice to be aware of all the ways that we hold duality, loving over here, hating over here, light over here, dark over here. Sometimes we hold duality between what we like or don't like. And to remember that our practice is to meet what is beyond label with compassionate awareness. So this means whether we find ourselves in what we might call a room filled with lights, a brightly lit room where we're comfortable and can see well, or we find ourselves in a completely dark room, the lights are off and our familiar orientation is gone and we feel really uncomfortable, that our job is to simply pay attention to what is present right now. Can I notice with as much subtlety and nuance the details of the shades on the wall and the texture of the floor in this metaphorical room? Yeah, to just really pay attention. So to pay attention more subtly to your internal experience when you find yourself in the loving place and in the hating place, so that instead of going from expansion to contraction, you're aware that there is an emergent quality to expansion, contraction. We experience the full spectrum. Yeah, the Buddha taught that each and every one of us contains everything that's happened from before the beginning of beginningless time. So that positions us to drop some of those labels, even between love and hate, and meet what is with a quality of attention that I would call caring and loving itself. I hope that's helpful. Yeah, yeah. I would also just suggest you use your body as much to help you. Sometimes the practice of breathing in difficulty through the center of our heart and out through the back can be useful when we're navigating things that really trigger us deeply, such as state of the world. Someone shared, "I'm very grateful for your invitation to reflect and turn towards what I acknowledge I sometimes turn away from out of fear of my emotion, especially despair and judgment. And I'm wondering about the false dichotomy or false duality between acceptance for what is and the drive, motivation to take action." Yeah. I think it's really important to speak to. And this is part of what I was pointing to in appreciating the multidimensionality that practice holds, the both and nature, rather than this or that, so that you all can look to your own experience. But what I've witnessed is when we turn to conditioning to either find false safety or, let's say, to go to a conclusion, conditioning often has a story of, what am I gonna do to get out of this? What do we got to do to get out of this? What do we got to do to get away from this feeling? For instance, the pain of what we've inherited. We might go directly to, okay, so there's action. I'm gonna do something. And in that, we might leave the seat. Remember, I talked a lot about taking our seat, the seat of acceptance, the seat of dignity. What I've seen in my own experience, both as an activist and in Dharma, is that the two actually work together most beautifully. It's when I rest most fully in acceptance, like really opening my heart to being with what is, to seeing clearly what is, without both labeling it and trying to get away from it or solve, fix, change it, that there's a sort of an inner healing that occurs through acceptance. We bring ourselves more into our interconnected relationship with life, our oneness with life, okay? And clearer response arises. So if there's action to take, it arises from a different place. I talk sometimes about visionary activism. Some of you might have heard me speak to that. But it means that when we're accepting, we're really able to listen more deeply and to access the receptive aspect of our nature, which is often overlooked, in order to receive clearer action. And so I appreciate this question, because sometimes, especially when it comes to state of the world, there's a lot of judgment and finger pointing. If you are in some degree of acceptance, it's resignation. Or if you're in some degree of acceptance, then you are not taking action. And I don't see them as having to be separate. The last thing I'll say about this is just that we tend to think of action only as doing outward things. I really love the meeting point between the inner and outer work. I think there's so much of both to be done. But I really believe that there are both actions to take and non-doing actions. Meaning, I think the way I'll put it is this. A writer who I really love named Adrienne Marie Brown writes about the difference between inch wide, mile deep movements and mile wide, inch deep movements. And when we are not deep listening and taking skillful actions, you know, there's a tendency in our world to do things big or want to make something change without bringing the depth to it that's needed. And something I see about Dharma practice is I see ways every single day that in addition to taking the outer actions that are needed, there's a lot of room for people who show up fully present to participate in mile deep, inch wide movements. I hope that resonates for you. So let's see, someone has written, "Thank you for the permission to grieve for our predicament. I do not always feel Dharma teachers are receptive to this. and often reflect it back as something to be defended against. I'll just affirm, I do believe that collective grieving now is one of the most important actions we can take. I will stand by this because this is how we metabolize, integrate our experience down in our bodies, our interconnected bodies, so that we can free up energy, give back to the soil, feel our absolute togetherness in this. And I feel that this is a huge part of what is needed. Our grief is our medicine, is what I'm trying to say. I don't have any on the calendar right now, but at times I offer on my through my website a ritual called the Truth Mandala, which is a collective grieving ritual. And I will be offering a couple of retreats in the beginning of next year about practice and climate change, where we actually get to go a lot deeper. Today is just a touching in. Do you have suggestions for addressing climate change with children? If you might be willing to send me an email, then I can look at my resource list for books, because this is the place where there are a few really skillful books written. It's such a tender topic. It's such a tender topic with my nephews who are 5, 6, 7, with my nieces, one who just started college. I cried so many tears just reflecting on the world she's stepping into versus the world I was stepping into when I was her age. I feel that this is one of the reasons we in ourselves need to do our own grief work and need to drop beyond concepts and ideas into embodiment so that we can be of service to those around us, to each other, and support the human spirit while we navigate global uncertainty. Yeah. Someone wrote, what do you see as the relationship between emergence and emergency in this context? Thank you for this work. That's a great question. And before I answer it, I'm just also going to ask George for support to check if there have been any questions that have been missed while I'm answering this. And I would first say, this is a question that I want to bring some inquiry to. So let me just look within for a moment. You know, what's arising is the Chinese symbol for crisis translates twofold. It translates to both danger and opportunity, danger and opportunity. And of course, this is a great symbol for the climate crisis. It's so layered. It is so layered because when we go just into need to respond through urgency, need to respond to emergency through urgency, at least in myself, like that triggers me to go into a sort of tense, off-centered, perhaps reactive, fear-based place. And I find the most skillful place for all action to come from center. So I like replacing the word urgency with immediacy, which reminds us that when we recognize emergence, that all of life is an emergent process. Our entire life is an emergent process. We are constantly part of a collaborative emergent process. We can literally take refuge in the present, in the moment. That is our call to anchor in the moment. And we know that the moment, this moment, is both all we've got, and this moment is the most skillful place from which to respond to life. And so if I want to serve beings of the future, if I want to be of service to those who have gone before, the ancestors and beings of the future, which I think is an important context when we're looking at addressing what we're up against now, because it's addressing a collective momentum, which has gone on for a really long time. responding from present moment wisdom gives us access, I'm going to say this term again, to a larger compass, a larger and more intelligent inner compass. The mind of separation, the conditioned mind, which is also the mind of limitation, let's just emphasize that. It's very limited. It's very fear-based. You know, when we become fully present, and earlier in the talk I said that I think it's time to emphasize certain aspects of our practice in response to what's going on now that are not always the ones most emphasized. I'm really speaking about our relational intelligence, the inner compass that is a different source of intelligence to listen to. Of course, I'm talking about the integrated body-mind, but in service to our relationships. And there's one more thing I want to name about that. Let's see if it comes back. Give me a moment. I just want to name that even in this conversation, there are moments when, because of the emergency quality of what's going on, I can feel in the energetic field a tendency to want to go up here to respond. I can feel in our shared field a tendency at times for people to want to go into familiar patterns of reacting rather than listening within first. So when you ask about the relationship between emergence and emergency, I feel that a balance of knowing how to slow down so that we can access this inner compass, slowing down in the face of emergency, what? Yes, just slowing down enough to really be at center and then seeing what comes to us and through us from a place beyond our conditioned mind. That's part of visionary activism. And that might be a future talk because I'm just naming it today. Okay. I want to name the tenderness and the vulnerability of today's topic. And there's one more question that hasn't been answered. So, okay. Let me see if I can access it. Give me one moment. You mention of those who live keeping it light as a posture. Hold on. I just had it and then I lost it. Patience with the technology. Would you comment on how to be with and not react to those in our lives who stick with that practice? Yes. With everything relating to climate crisis, for instance, there's so much invitation to access our compassion, acceptance, and patience with greed, hate, and delusion across the board. We could do an entire retreat just on that right now. But we have to acknowledge that it's so popular in the dominant paradigm to hold a duality between light and dark and to want to focus on the light and to label or put in the category of dark all that we want to turn away from. The book that I just finished writing is all about darkness, divine darkness, darkness as a profound teacher in our lives, in our practice, in this time of global uncertainty, and redefining how we see darkness, because as human beings and practitioners, we are here for the full spectrum, and both light and dark are our great teachers. But in terms of when we witness people just trying to keep it light, or look within yourself, when you notice yourself trying to go there, you can acknowledge the pain, the suffering that's underneath that. And I would use that as a reminder of the importance and the way it's of service to the whole, to cultivate one's own discomfort resiliency, turning towards that which we're uncomfortable from in the right increments to deepen in our ability to be present with this, so that we can be models for going beyond the sunshine or keeping it light tendency. I'll just remind all of us that the deepest joy available to human beings is the joy that comes when we drop the duality of light and dark, and we are willing to be present with and open our hearts to the full spectrum, the full spectrum. When we drop the idea of positive negative, that is pretty anchored in, I'm going to use the phrase, the dominant paradigm. Okay. So I really appreciate people's comments and questions. And I really appreciate Sangha Live for this space. I always love teaching the Sangha Live. I love coming together with people from all over for deepening our practice in this way. Remember that there's a resource list on my website if you'd like, and there are certain offerings, including a six-month training called The Heart of Listening that is for practitioners and leaders that begins in November. That's really about cultivating the quality of presence, going way deeper with this notion of accessing the inner compass and taking our seats and service in a time of change. So if that calls to any of you, you're welcome to reach out about it. And I want to, as part of thanking Sangha Live, just remind people that Sangha Live is operated through the practice of Dana, generosity. They are such an incredible team I've worked with many, many times. And what it takes for their collaboration, for the smooth sailing of these teachings, for all of the background work and communications, what it takes for the teachers who come here to offer time and service, your donation, your generosity is a real contribution. And it's, for me, an experience of reciprocity and we consciousness, how we support our teachers and the teachings. So thank you for hearing me out on that. I would like to dedicate the merit of our time together today, the honesty and kindness and courage and love and grief in this space to all beings throughout time and space, seen and unseen, visible and invisible, every form of life, every animal, mineral, plant, fungi, microorganism. If you can take a moment and just allow yourself to feel the merit of our time together going down to nourish the earth beneath you, right where you are, right where you are. Thank you, everyone. Grateful to be here with you today.